My guest this week worked as an art historian and journalist before publishing her first memoir, Have You Been Good, in 2015, about growing up in one of Britain's most aristocratic and artistic families. Her second memoir, a series of vignettes called The Truth Game, was released earlier this year. She's married to the British author Andrew Davidson. She lives in Sissinghurst in Kent, and that should give you a big clue as to who she is. Vanessa Nicholson, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for coming in. I think it's really worth revisiting your family bibliographical and biographical tree.
Yes. I'm half Italian. On the English side, my father, Ben Nicholson, was an art historian and he died very suddenly in 1978. He was the eldest son of Vita Sackville-West and Harold Nicholson, and he loved Sissinghurst, but he was a very urban man and his life was with the art world in London, really. And so he inherited from his parents some artworks, but the castle itself, Sissinghurst Castle, was inherited by Nigel, the younger brother. And then in discussion with Ben, it was passed to the National Trust. My father did contribute to a sort of endowment because the National Trust were very concerned about taking on this castle. But anyway, now it's incredibly popular and there are, you know, hundreds and thousands of visitors every year. Well, not thousands, but hundreds. So he was my English side, really. And he met my mother, who was a Florentine academic, working with the art historian Bernard Berenson. She was his assistant and lived in this beautiful villa, Itati, just on the outskirts of Florence. And my father arrived there as a young man studying art history and developed this very intense sort of intellectual friendship with my mother, Louisa. They did get married, but they divorced. The marriage didn't go well, and they divorced shortly after they married. And my mother took me back to live in Florence with her parents.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of a literary legacy, of course, that's massive within your family too.
All my family wrote, you know, my grandparents on both sides, actually. My Italian grandfather was a professor of philosophy. My mother wrote books on art history. My father wrote. So I sort of grew up with this sense that writing was integral to life, was something that you did all the time. If it wasn't, it didn't necessarily have to be something academic, but, you know, I was taught to write my diary every night. You know, you say your prayers and then you write your diary. Mm. So I grew up with this feeling that it was like brushing your teeth, you know.
Mm. And of course, not only your family themselves writing, but many people have written about your family.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I have to say, I had a rather troubled childhood and teenage life, and I completely rejected any association with this famous literary family. And at that time, it was, you know, it's become more famous now. But I wasn't really interested. I didn't want to know. I didn't want to be associated with people who were famous. I mean, even going to university, and I did study art history because I wasn't quite sure what else to study because I'd messed up all my A-levels and I could see my parents did it quite easily and thought, well, that will be easy, you know. And then I became, despite myself, quite interested in art and art history. But, you know, there were situations at Sussex University when, you know, people would mention a writer and I'd met them, you know, I'd met them through my father or they knew my grandparents. And I felt very confused about it in a way because I wasn't quite sure what my tribe was. You know, I was a kind of scruffy hippie and yet I had this thing sitting on my shoulders. And it was almost like you're damned if you're part of it and you're damned if you're not. Mm. You know, there was an interest in it, if I did reveal my connection, that I was always quite suspicious of. You know, is this person only interested in me or am I only interesting because of this association? Who am I? You know, and this is part of the issues that I've explored really in these two memoirs. Mm.
Do you think that that weight then of literary expectation is what kept you from writing until 2015?
I always wrote and I sort of separated my two different kinds of writing. I worked as an art journalist in the 80s and I did publish catalogue essays and I published a book on a sculpture. But I divided the academic work from the writing I was doing virtually every day, which was carrying on this tradition of private writing, of making sense of things through confessional stuff in journals or just trying to work things out very privately, just for my own eyes and nobody else's. So it's quite interesting how when I started writing my first memoir, you know, I was kind of revealing things that I maybe had revealed in these diaries, but I was applying an academic approach to it. So I was looking at sources, I was looking at letters between my parents. There's a huge archive of stuff because they were all writers. And I had masses of photographs, diaries, journals from way back, and none of my family throw anything away. So all that documentation went into writing about quite private things. So the two things came together, really.
So what was the moment then when you decided to make that very private writing public in this way?
It was a slow process. I didn't wake up one day and think, I'm now going to write my memoir. This terrible thing happened in the summer of 2008, whereby my youngest daughter, Rosa, who had epilepsy, went swimming and had a seizure while she was swimming and drowned. And so I felt that the only way I could kind of cope with this terrible grief, well, one of the ways, was to write. And so I started writing about her, and I was writing sort of letters to her about what was going on and how I felt. And I started then writing about her childhood as though I was kind of fixing it somehow, putting her back into the world in a way. And I had quite a lot of material that I never dreamed I would actually publish it. But I did show a few pieces to close friends, and I was enjoying the process of writing. It was really helping me. And so I started doing a sort of more creative writing course because my writing had always been academic. And so I began thinking about how stories are put together. And I'd always enjoyed telling stories, you know, orally, sort of to friends and things and anecdotes. So, you know, these classes made me see how a narrative takes form, and you have character and plot and pace and backwards and forwards. And so my writing began taking a form, really, of a book. And then I came across something in a book about a relative, something that my grandmother Vita had said about me in a letter. This was all published, you know. And it was quite a shock reading these words. It said it was a letter from Vita to her cousin, her first cousin, Eddie Sackville West. And it was dated May 1956. I was born in August 56. And she writes, "Ben and Louisa came to stay at Sissinghurst. They're going to have a baby in August." And this, I read this and I thought, oh my God, that's me. And then the next line is, "What a funny little mongrel it will be." And because my mother's Italian. And I had this incredible epiphanic moment. I had sort of shivers down my spine. I thought, this is exactly what I've always felt to be, a mongrel, you know, half Italian, half English, not quite fitting in any place or feeling like I didn't. Who are my friends? Where do I fit? Which group should I be in? Always trying to fit in and not succeeding a lot of the time. And so I started writing about that. And I left the Rosa material for a bit. And I started writing about my own childhood. And then because I was doing these courses and interested in the forms that narratives take, I played around with it. And I, with the help actually of my husband, who's a writer, he read some of it and he suggested sort of threading different time scales, you know, together. So I alternated stories about my daughter with stories about my childhood. And what emerged was this sense of what it means, you know, to be a daughter, what it means to be a mother. I had a very complicated relationship with my mother. And so that's how that book came together.
Mm. And that's called Have You Been Good? Yeah. It came out in 2015, published by Granta.
Yeah.
This next book is, again, beautiful, beautiful book. It's called The Truth Game. And I love the way that you've put it together. It's the series of different vignettes. It starts off describing the seven deadly sins.
Yes.
And envy.
Yes.
And then that feeds into shame. And I wonder why there was that focus on shame.
Yes. Well, The Truth Game, the title comes from a game I used to play with my father. And we used to ask each other questions. And the only rule was that you had to answer truthfully. And what emerged was, of course, that often we didn't give truthful answers. And I remembered a journey, a very, very vividly. I remembered this train journey to the south of France when I was about 15, 16, and playing the truth game with my father. And the reason it stayed in my memory was because we started playing this game and I asked him, I said, apart from with mummy, with my mother, were you ever in love with somebody so much that you would have liked to marry them? And this memory has stayed with me of his face, that he became terribly sad. And he said, I was very much in love with somebody, but I was not able to marry them. And I was excited by this because I thought, you know, I said, oh, do I know her? Who was she? You know, I wanted the whole story. And he changed the subject very abruptly. And that's why I remember it. And of course, the reason he had looked like that and had changed the subject was because my father was gay. And his great love, the great love of his life, was this man, this art dealer. And it had gone rather horribly wrong. And I don't think he ever quite got over it. And so thinking about that, in my rooting around in the archive of my family, I'd found journals and diaries written by my father about this affair. Now, obviously, I'd found them much, much later as an adult. And what had struck me so much was the terrible shame that he had felt and the frustrations of not being able to come to terms with this. I mean, he felt that he was disgusting in some way, that he was a terrible person for having these feelings. And I know, you have to see it in the context of the time. And this was the reason, his homosexuality, that the marriage didn't work out with my mother, or one of the main reasons, I think, because also he became very withdrawn and depressed over this issue. And my mother was very unforgiving. And I'd had, as I say, this troubled teenage life. And my mother had read my diary when I was about 14 and become hysterical over it. She said I was a whore and all sorts of things because she'd read, you know, about boys and things. And so I was thinking quite a lot about shame and envy as well, because I think it's interesting the way people have fantasies about other people's lives, back to this idea of the group and the tribe and where do I fit in. I know I have been, you know, the object of this fantasy that how wonderful to have been born in this literary family, how amazing to have grown up in Florence, you know, these two incredible things.
And to spend time,
and to spend time at Sissinghurst. And in fact, the real story was that, you know, I had rather a miserable childhood and it wasn't what it seems on the surface. Now, I do the opposite. I fantasize when people have kind of what appears to be very ordinary lives, you know, mum, dad, granny and grandpa, and it's all nobody famous, and they've had secure, stable childhoods. I envy that terribly. I mean, Christmas is a nightmare because I'm always thinking, oh, I wish, you know, I had Auntie so-and-so to go and see in Hull or something, you know. And so having had this training as an art historian as well, I found images very comforting where they mirror back something. So to see these personifications of these feelings it makes me realise that they're quite common, these feelings, shame, envy, you know, depression, inconstancy or whatever. And there's this wonderful chapel in Padova with these personifications, these allegories painted by Giotto of these characters who represent these emotions. And so I start off with that.
I thought it was so interesting, given what you've said about feeling very private and quite reluctant for this to come out, that in the first of these series of vignettes, which is just called Daughter, which is obviously you, you choose not to write in the first person.
Yes. There are, I think, three times in that book, in this book, The Truth Game, where I write about myself in the third person. There are a couple of reasons. I started it as a sort of experiment to see how it read, whether it read differently from saying I. But it was more than that. It was also that I could see myself and my father on that train so vividly, like a film. I mean, absolutely. I could see this young girl in her loons, you know, and her long hair, sitting opposite her dad. And it was so visual that I almost reported it as if I was describing a film. So that was the first time. And the second time I did that was when I tell the story of an awful encounter in Greece as a young woman in my early 20s, when a taxi driver, Greek taxi driver, sort of behaved rather badly and I got stuck with him in a hotel. And I did that in the third person because at the time I had disassociated from the situation. It was the only way I could cope with it. So I detached as though I was moving my soul and my brain and away from my body. So my body could be doing what it wanted, but I was looking at it. And so I wrote it like that as well. Mm. And the last time was sort of, it bookends. So the last vignette is what happened, you know, at the end of that train journey with my father. So it seemed appropriate to write it in that way as well. So there are these three points in the book.
Mm. As we say, the series of vignettes, but each one sort of revisits or gives us the backstory to some important person and, and time in your life. So, for instance, we have Julie, your childhood friend in Italy. We have Mr. Wright, who is the man that you had a huge crush on in your fourth year of university. And one incredibly moving and very powerful piece is Adam. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Adam was, when I say Adam, people who know the family often think it's going to be about my cousin, Adam Nicholson, but it has nothing to do with him. Adam was the boyfriend of Rosa, the daughter who died at university. She had this 1 year at university. And I was calling people up and approaching people, as you say, who had meant something to me in my life, to have conversations with sometimes, to go over things that hadn't been quite resolved or looking back. And I really, a lot of them were old. You know, I'm in my early 60s, so a lot of them were old. I really wanted somebody young. And Adam is an interesting character. He's from a very different background. He's ambitious. He's up for things. And he was great. He came over. And there's been something that had been really bothering me for years because Adam kept in touch with us. In fact, he stayed with us for a few weeks after Rosa died. You know, I'm very fond of him. And he was devastated. He was really in pieces, understandably. And I felt this huge kind of affection for him. Anyway, he went back to university and we did sort of vaguely keep in touch. But something happened. I used to sit in front of my computer on Rosa's Facebook account that was still logged in to the computer at home. And I could see what her friends were up to and everything. And it made me feel connected to her. And one day I saw Adam had written something to a new girlfriend. And he was clearly in a loving relationship. This was 6 months later. And of course, he has every right. And I'd sat with him and said to him, Adam, you know, you're 19. You must not let this ruin your life. You will have other relationships, all this. But when I was faced with that moment, I just couldn't bear it. And I wrote a message to him. Well, it came through as if it was from Rosa, because I was logged into her account. So I wrote, isn't it a bit soon to be in love with somebody else? And I pressed this send thing, and then I just froze in my chair, thinking, what have I done? This is going to come through to him as his dead girlfriend, you know, with a picture of her and everything. It was a terrible thing to have done. You know, I apologised profusely and all that, but we'd never really talked about it. So he arrived to have this morning of conversation, and he brought some films of Rosa that I'd never seen, which was also very strange to see my dead daughter in films, acting in sort of ways that she would never have acted if she'd known that her mother was watching. I learnt a lot of things about her that I hadn't known, like when she took, you know, ecstasy or something at a club, and I, oh no, you know. He was very frank, Adam, and in a way that was helpful because I could be frank as well. And I apologised again, and we talked through this awful incident. And that really tells that story.
Profoundly, profoundly moving. As you say, you bookend the work with memories of your father. And in the last one, in Ben, you talk about watching him on television in a BBC documentary on Virginia Woolf. And of course, so we're back to the whole sort of Bloomsbury group thing again. And of course, you continue to watch that after he died.
Yes, I watched it the first time as a schoolgirl in matron's room, you know. I think it was aired in the late 60s. And that was then, because that he was on, my daddy was on the television. That was very exciting. And then I noticed it was shown in the 80s, and my early 80s, my father died a sort of 2 or 3 years before, and I watched it live then, because of course there was no recording equipment. And then I watched it a third time, and each time I watched it was a sort of different experience. Very strange to watch somebody who you've loved very deeply and who is dead, to see them come alive in film. It is an extraordinary sensation. And of course, you bring something different according to what situation you're in yourself. So when I watched my father the last time after Rosa had died, it had an added sadness, an added sort of melancholy. When I'd watched it through 2 or 3 years after he died, it was still raw, the grief. So I was just focused on reliving the fact that my father was moving around and I could see him talking and hear him, you know. And the first time I wasn't interested in Virginia Woolf at all, aged 12 or 13. I was just thinking, oh, that's my dad, you know, on the telly.
And are you interested now? Do you feel that kind of weight of history and a kind of responsibility, I suppose, to carry on that the whole sort of legacy of the group?
No, I'm very selfish in that way. I just think I'm doing what I needed to do, and I want to sort of express things that often aren't expressed. And I'm not really interested if it's connected in some way to something I feel very detached from, actually.
One thing that I can absolutely tell you is that regardless of your family history, although, of course, what it does do is enrich the story, you are so clearly such a talented writer.
Oh, you're
off
kind.
Your own bat. And I would absolutely recommend this book. It's beautifully, beautifully
thank you.
Written.
Thank you.
And deeply moving.
Thank you very much.
Vanessa, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
The Truth Game by Vanessa Nicholson is published by Quartet Books. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough, Katie Watkins, Daphne Karnitsas and Sam Impey. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.